Hi, I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokane7.com.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, full-time law professor at Gonzaga University School of Law.
And I'm Nathan Weinbender, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio and film and music editor for The Inlander.
And welcome to Movies 101, the show that works hard to keep tight the relationship, not just between we three movie reviewers, but also with our producer-engineer, Peter Glarberg. And if we haven't said it enough, thanks, Pete, for all you do. Relationships, no surprise, are on the docket this week, courtesy of the three films that we will be discussing. The study of faulty family dynamics, The Nest, followed by the mother-daughter horror show, Run, and ending with a revised take on one of Charles Dickens's most popular novels, this version titled The Personal History of David Copperfield. Let's begin this week's show by looking at the plight of a family facing turmoil. In his 2011 film, Marthy, Marcy, May, Marlene, and that's a mouthful, writer-director Sean Durkin explored the world of a woman who escapes a cult only to struggle with the emotional and psychological issues that had landed her there in the first place. In The Nest, Durkin takes us into a world that is far less dangerous, but no less trying for anyone who has any familiarity with family dysfunction. Rory and Allison O'Hara, played by Ju Law and Carrie Coons, and their children constitute a blended family, one in which repressed emotions and misplaced ambitions follow them from America as they move to England and onto an estate located just outside London. Rory is a kind of money manager, a guy who talks big and fast, while Allison is attached more to a horse than even to her children, even though she appears on the surface to be a good mom. Things begin to break down slowly, and it all happens in a way that seems spooky and even at times laden almost with paranormal twists, but ultimately works as yet another, though suitably intense, variation on the psychological themes explored in, most recently, Noah Baumbach's 2019 film Marriage Story. And while all through this movie, I was critical of it in almost every way imaginable, 24 hours later, it was still working on me. So Durkin makes movies that will affect you in one way or another.
I would agree with that. I mean, we were having a conversation about it probably 18 hours later, and then it came up once again. So it's hard to describe The Nest. Dan made reference to Marriage Story, and it's not about the denouement of a marriage. It's about the denouement of this family, really. And it's also the inside portrait of somebody who's like an extreme narcissist, which is, we've discovered, driven by terrible insecurity. And so we meet the male protagonist, Jude Law, Rory O'Hara. Just that name alone, which does not trip off your tongue easily, should have been a clue to his childhood. But he obviously thinks big, grandiose. He's a larger than life character. And we're initially don't know, is this guy a con man? Is he just the world's most optimistic human? But we soon find out what's really going on here. This couple lives with their blended family, as Dan pointed out, in upstate New York. But Rory has a great opportunity for them to move back to London. He's British, she's American. And so they find themselves in this creepy old house out in Surrey. And the only reason that Allison is happy, as Dan indicated, is because she is a riding instructor, she's an equestrian, and she's able to have her horse there with her, almost to the exclusion of her two children. But the horse becomes a metaphor for everything that happens to this family and in this movie. And so I don't want to tell everything about what transpires, but we actually had to look up something online to see if it were physically possible that this one event would happen, because that really sort of is a shock the groggy moment. But I think that this film works well because of the two leads, so Jude Law and Carrie Coons. I also think it works well as a contrast between sort of this stuffy British society and America, which is more open, at least arguably so. The problem that I had was it's supposed to take place in the 1980s, and maybe because I've been watching too much of The Crown, I never got one sense, except for things that we hear over the radio, that this was occurring in the 1980s. And I decided that ultimately was purposeful, because it's not stuck in a place and time. And it's not really about what was happening during that time period. It really is about what's happening sort of writ small. And the performances by the two kids who are half siblings are really, I think, pretty amazing, because they have to sort of pretend, they have to protect mom at the same time. They have to go along with dad. They have to protect themselves from everything that's happening. And this is a slow, slow crumbling. And then at the end, we're left with, what's going to happen next? And I can't answer that.
Yeah, I want to go back to the time period that you mentioned, because I think the movies that I would most liken The Nest to would be something like Ang Lee's The Ice Storm or Todd Haynes's Safe, in the sense that it's a period piece about a family falling apart, about a marriage coming apart, but it's also tapping into the specific hangups of the era in which it's set. So as you mentioned, it is kind of unmoored from time in the way that we expect a movie to be tapped into the era in which it's set. And I think that's meant to kind of discombobulate us a little bit. But here we have a couple that are basically being suffocated by the expectations of the go-go 80s, of yuppiedom in general, of the cutthroat capitalism that really defined the Reagan era. We especially see that in the Jude Law character. And they think that being successful in, you know, the financial markets is going to save this relationship, which has, from what we can tell, been doomed for a long time. I mean, you know, moving away into the country is not going to save this particular family unit, I don't think. And that creepy element that you mentioned, Dan, I mean, the camera in this movie always seems to be kind of creeping up on its characters or spying on them from the other room or from around the corner. And I think that's indicative of Durkin's style. Now, granted, we've only seen two films from him now, but it's very much of a piece with his debut, Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene, which I think is a great movie, kind of an undiscovered classic of the last decade or so. I really hope people rediscover that if they haven't seen it already. But there are definitely shades of Shirley Jackson or Henry James, Turn of the Screw in this, in a way, without ever tipping over into horror, because this house kind of seems to be pushing these people towards their breaking point. It's almost as if the house has a spell over them or something. And yet I think as the film The Nest goes on, it becomes pretty clear that it's the characters who are kind of prescribing the house with this power, but it's really their own doing. And so it's almost like they're trying to shift the blames away from themselves onto anything else, onto this new environment, onto the house in which they moved into. So I agree with you. It's a slow working kind of thing. It all comes to a head in a scene near the very end where Jude Law and Carrie Coon go to a fancy dinner, where Jude Law thinks that he's finally going to land this client that's going to turn his fortune around and it's going to make everything better again. And everything goes horribly wrong. And she ends up running off to a dance club by herself. And he ends up being abandoned in the city and taking a cab home. And the conversation he has with the cab driver, I think, is the key to unlocking this entire movie. And it really illuminates who this guy is and who he wants other people to think he is. And I think that once you get to that moment, everything else kind of falls into place. So you do kind of keep expecting it to fall into some kind of ghost story trapping or horror movie trappings, and it never really does. And so this one, it does kind of keep you on your toes, because as you said, you're not really sure where it's going to go. And then it just kind of ends. But I was enraptured by it for a long period of time. And I'm sure it's not going to be to everybody's liking. As you said, once it was over, you didn't even really like it that much, but it does kind of take up space in your brain a little bit. It
absolutely does. I think it's an interesting exercise in what's on paper versus what Durkin puts on screen, because another director might have had a completely different take on what's going on here. And we would have had a movie much more like Marriage Story or much more like the movies that you mentioned, Nathan, when you were talking about films of a similar type. It has that creepiness that his original movie had, and I think that's his sensibility, but it is really an interesting take on director's stylisms.
And there's some really sort of hidden humor in it here and there, because we want to jump through the screen and sort of strangle Rory at different points. But they go to a party and Allison, his wife, is completely overlooked. And, you know, so she sort of introduces herself and says something to the effect that, "I'm Allison. I guess that was hard to remember," or something along those lines. And it was just kind of classic. It was the way she was being dismissed at the same time.
Because she's the wife.
Right, right. And it really was this arm candy sort of era that we saw. And it was just sort of shocking and disconcerting. And then there's another scene where she decides she has to take control of the family finances because he screwed it up so badly. And I really liked that scene. So we see that, you know, at one point he says, "Oh, you came from nothing," or whatever. But she was willing to work. She was willing to acknowledge her roots. And then the final thing I want to mention is his scene when he goes to visit his mom.
Oh, yeah, and, yeah, yeah.
That was one of the, except for Tony Soprano, that was one of, with his mom, that was one of the most, I think, revealing sequences in the entire film.
Right. And Jude Law, I mean, we know that he can do great work, but Carrie Coon is really starting to grow on me. I mean, she's such a great character actress, so good in Gone Girl in that second season of the Fargo TV show. I think her performance is the great one here, and it would be great to see her get some awards consideration if people actually seek this movie out.
Yeah, yeah. And I think we just proved that there's a lot more to The Nest than we all thought when we initially watched it. That was The Nest. This is Movies 101, and it's time to take a short break. Before we go, remember that you can access podcasts of Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to look at Run and the personal history of David Copperfield. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
Hey, I'm Elsa Chang from NPR. Giving Tuesday is about coming together and being generous with our time, our energy, and when possible, our money. It's ultimately about respect for people we know, for those we don't know, and for the work that organizations like this NPR station do to make our communities better. As a journalist, it's important to me to approach stories with respect. And by that, I mean trying my best to not let assumptions creep in. And if I do have assumptions, to acknowledge them and to try to leave enough room for someone to surprise me or challenge me or to teach me a new way to frame an issue. Anytime someone is willing to sit down for an interview, they're placing some trust in me to fully listen to them. This Giving Tuesday, donate to support journalism that treats everyone with respect. Here's how to give.
Please go to SpokanePublicRadio.org and give today. Thank you.
And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbender, and I discussed The Nest. Let's now move to Run and the personal history of David Copperfield. Let's begin with a movie that questions the validity of one mother's love. Sarah Paulson is getting typecast in various appearances on the FX series American Horror Story and in her starring role in the Netflix series Ratched. She famously portrays demented characters. And the same holds true for Run, a top thriller directed and co-written by Anish Chaganti, in which she portrays a woman whose love for her daughter, well, let's just say it gives new meaning to the terms possessive and protective. Paulson plays Diane Sherman, a woman who, since the premature of her daughter Chloe, played by newcomer Kira Allen, has cared for the girl, who, despite dealing with a number of health woes, is about to finish her homeschooling and is waiting for her acceptance to college. But through chance, she begins to suspect something is drastically wrong. Allen, who in real life does use a wheelchair, is surprisingly good, and Paulson is frightening. But we already knew that, just as any fan of, say, Alfred Hitchcock Presents will know pretty much not only where Run is going, but where it will end.
Yeah, and I agree with you here. I think we're on the same page. And we were big fans of Chaganti's first film, which was called Searching, which was this sort of missing person mystery that was done almost as like a found footage thriller where you saw, you know, people's phones,
right?
and social media profiles. And that was a really clever film. And here, this is much more pedestrian and I think not nearly as exciting, even though you do have those two really good central performances by Paulson and especially Kira Allen, who I mean, what an impressive debut. She's really good in this. But this movie, it goes from being sort of unnerving to kind of unbelievable to totally wildly preposterous in just a matter of scenes. There was a moment in the movie where I said out loud, oh, this is about to get really silly, isn't it? And I was right. It was about to get really silly. And yet this movie Run, it's lacking, I think, in two qualities that when I say them are going to sound diametrically opposed to one another. One, it's not crazy enough. It's not totally insane like it needs to be. And it also doesn't delve enough into the complexities of those two central characters. I don't really know who these people are. I don't really get a glimpse into their dynamic beyond the suspicion that the daughter feels towards the mother and the overprotectedness that the mother feels towards the daughter. So that when they get run through this insane thriller plot, I don't really care what's going to happen to them. I think you kind of have to do both. You sort of have to toe that line between real drama and sort of camp almost in order for this kind of material to work. And I don't think they quite thread that needle. And there's even a kicker at the end, which does feel like an Alfred Hitchcock Presents plot or like a Tales from the Crypt kind of thing. And it really should have worked because it has this kind of poisonous irony about it, but it just kind of fell flat because I don't know. I just felt like everything was a little bit arbitrary here. So I really wanted to get caught up in the wildness of Run, and it never really quite kicked into gear for me.
I think that you do feel the claustrophobia and the isolation that this...
It's like Misery at the beginning.
Yes, exactly, that this teenage girl feels. And of course, you know, she doesn't have an iPhone, she doesn't have internet, she's being homeschooled, so this is probably one of the worst advertisements for homeschooling. Here she is with a disability, and she definitely needs more social interaction, which she doesn't get through any means. But there are a couple of really good scenes. There's one scene where she calls somebody on the telephone, and I'm not going to reveal more about it, but that scene, you know, she's looking out the window, checking on her mom, and then she's trying, you know, it's one of those scenes where you're just, please, please, please let her finish what she's doing before mom discovers what's happening and so forth. But I mean, this is loosely based on a real story of a woman who faked her daughter's disability, even unknown to the daughter, but she was using it for a fundraising tool. And we find out that in actuality, the Sarah Paulson character is using this for much more self-serving, illness-oriented means. And so
horror movie purposes, basically. Yeah.
I think the one thing we can all agree upon is that the two performances are terrific, especially by Alan. I mean, Paulson is, we've seen her enough to know that she's a talented actress, but Alan, a newcomer, what an amazing first-time performance. And that was Run. Let's close with the personal history of David Copperfield. At this point, it's difficult to say just how many adaptations on stage, screen, or TV have been made of Charles Dickens's massive 1850 novel, David Copperfield. And by massive, I mean 624 pages in its first published edition following its release in serial form. In his version, which he co-wrote with Simon Blackwell, director Armando Iannucci updates Dickens' story for a 21st century audience, including casting several central characters with actors of various ethnicities, including Indian-born actor Dev Patel as the adult version of our protagonist. A number of characters, too, have disabilities, and one, the unctuous Uriah Heep, is played with an intense obsequiousness by the openly gay actor Ben Whishaw. All of which is refreshing in the same sense that Lin-Manuel Miranda's Hamilton is refreshing and how it offers a revised way through which to imagine history. But another Iannucci stylism, that of quick pacing, though well-suited for a tweet-rooted generation, tends to blow quickly past most of Dickens's best prose, even as it gives actors such as Hugh Laurie, Peter Capaldi, and Nikki Amuka-Bird ample room to flesh out the author's more quirky characters. This particular personal history might actually play better on the stage, which is something that Mary Pat and I thought all the way through. Would love to have been in the theater watching these people.
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, I think if you did this particular version of David Copperfield on a stage, all the actors would be breathless from running around, and you'd have to constantly be moving sets because, as you said, they've taken this massive doorstopper of a novel and condensed it down to 2 hours. So I think it probably has to be done as a film in order for it to work the way that Iannucci intends. But I should say that I'm just not as enamored of the David Copperfield story as Hollywood seems to be.
Nor am I.
I mean, I should probably give Charles Dickens another try at some point, but I've just never really connected with his prose. So maybe I'm the wrong person to review this movie because I don't have a personal history myself with David Copperfield in order to really kind of appreciate sort of how he's deviating from the original and kind of, you know, turning Dickens on its proverbial head. But I agree with you. I love the cast that he has assembled here. I love a lot of the stylistic touches. He uses some of these silent movie techniques throughout involving light and rear projection that really caught me by surprise and I found really lovely. So I ended up liking this for the most part, even though, as I said, I'm kind of a Copperfield neophyte in a lot of ways. So I would be curious to know what people who are familiar with the story think of this.
Yeah, and I'm definitely not an expert on Charles Dickens, but I guess I do prefer other things such as Oliver Twist or Little Dorrit. And this story has never really captured me in the same way, but I think it's very earnest. I think it's very sort of upbeat. I think, the visuals are pretty stunning. And I guess I just never completely was taken in by it, which I think is in contrast to the feeling and response that other people will have. And so even though I didn't appreciate this movie fully, I think that other people would enjoy it. And it's definitely, you know, there are some dark scenes because, of course, we know the story, but it's perfectly acceptable for kids to watch.
And that's sort of unusual for Armando Iannucci, if you think about it.
Yeah, don't you think? That was probably the biggest shock to find out that he was responsible for it. So, yeah, if you're a Dickens fan, if you're looking for something over the holidays, maybe to a family movie night, I think this would qualify.
Yeah. I want you both to know that I absolve both of you and Iannucci for maligning the greatest novelist in the English language, Charles Dickens.
Okay, fine.
That's just...
Thank you so much for your benevolence, Dan.
And we were just finished talking about the personal history of David Copperfield, and this is Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster, and early in the show, Nathan Weinbinder, Murray Pat Truthart, and I discussed The Nest and Run. Let's take this moment to thank Peter Glarberg again for both producing and engineering the show. And we thank you to our loyal listeners. We invite you back next week, same time, same spot on the radio dial, when we'll again check out all the best that streaming cinema has to offer. Until then, remember these words from the late, great Charles Dickens. Love, though said to be afflicted with blindness, is a vigilant watchman. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.